like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animal, talking animal, talking animal. Must be an animal. Come hear the animals. Talking animals. Talking animals.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. And on the program today, I've convened a panel discussion about the end of the Ringling Brothers Circus. More on that in a moment. But I need to first mention that 2 weeks from today, February 8th, the WMNF Winter Fun Drive begins. And I'll be on the air that very day, February 8th, at 10 a.m. Fundraising, let's hope. I'm typically assigned a towering goal, like $3,000 in less than an hour. So the only way to have a chance of reaching that goal is to receive early donations. So I hope you'll consider making an early pledge. Please visit talkinganimals.net for simple, easy ways to pledge early or drop a few bucks in the Talking Animals tip jar. And as usual, I'll offer some exclusive thank you gifts for certain donations, including a pair of amazing tickets to see Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, a pair of fantastic tickets to see Chris Rock, and a specially priced week-long stay at a condo on the Hawaiian island of Kauai. So again, please head to talkinganimals.net for information about these special thank you gifts and how you can pledge for them. On a different note, on last week's show, I interviewed W. Bruce Cameron and Catherine Michon, the screenwriters of A Dog's Purpose. And 2 hours later, TMZ posted that now infamous video. Ever since, I've been asked countless questions about the situation, including my opinion. As I noted last week, Catherine is a longtime friend and former client, while she and Bruce have donated multiple times in support of Talking Animals. So I'm recusing myself from officially weighing in. I will say, though, if you were disturbed by the TMZ clips, especially if you're inclined to fall in line behind the boycott of A Dog's Purpose that PETA has called for, I strongly recommend you read the highly informative piece by the film's producer, Gavin Pallone, in The Hollywood Reporter. It's available online, and I posted it on my Facebook pages on Monday, so you can access it that way. It's been shared 80-plus times between the two pages, so I think there's obviously something of value in Gavin's piece. Now, back to the Ringling panel discussion. I was inspired to present the panel on today's program because I was struck by the array of reactions provoked by the recent announcement that Feld Entertainment was shutting down the circus in May. As you might expect, longtime activists were thrilled by the news, but there were also great feelings expressed of ambivalence, sadness, disappointment, nostalgia, and so on. Central questions many people are grappling with include, what will become of the animals still performing in the Ringling Circus? The elephants you may recall were removed from the shows in May, and I plan, of course, to address them as well. Another central question, what about the enormous number of folks who will find themselves unemployed come this May? There are many other issues and concerns here. And with the four people I've invited today, I'm seeking to represent at least some of the many perspectives I've seen surface on social media and elsewhere. So let's meet the panelists. In alphabetical order, Dr. Janet Davis is a professor at the University of Texas in Austin, and historian who's done extensive research and writing about circuses. One of her books is The Circus Age, Culture and Society Under the American Big Top, and is in a position to offer a scholarly view of how the significant demise of Ringling can be placed within the history and evolution of circuses. Good morning, Janet.
Good morning. Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
All right. Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals. Aaron Greenwood is a non-practicing lawyer, former animal welfare editor at the Huffington Post, and journalist who's contributed to the Washington Post Animalia blog, the Dodo, and others, and holds a decidedly ambivalent, nuanced view of the Ringling News. Good morning, Aaron.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
You bet. Stephen Payne is the Vice President of Corporate Communications at Feld Entertainment, and in that capacity, he's served as the longtime spokesman for the Ringling Brothers Circus. He's also battling a nasty cold this morning, so I appreciate his hanging in there and remaining with us. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning, Duncan. Happy to be here. Wish I was in sunny Florida where it was warmer, and maybe I could get rid of this cold.
That might help you shake it, for sure. And Adam Sigalski is the Executive Director of One Protest, the Florida-based advocacy organization known for its successful effort to help halt the Florida bear hunt, has long protested the Ringling Circus. He did so as recently as Sunday in Jacksonville, Florida. And, of course, is thrilled about the news that the Ringling Circus is ending. Good morning, Adam.
Hey, good morning, Duncan. Thank you for having me on this show and having this very important topic discussed from all points of view.
All right. So let's, in fact, get to it. So the weekend before last is when most of us heard the news that Feld Entertainment was shutting down the circus after 146 years. Steve, I suspect you heard this news a good deal sooner, so we'll circle back to you in a moment. But I'd like to ask each of the others of you to hark back to that moment when you first heard the news and recall that initial reaction. Let's start with you, Aaron.
I mean, on the one hand, it was a great victory for the people who have been fighting for the animals that are performing in the circus. And on the other hand, there's a part of me that felt sad to hear that the circus was closing. I outside of the animal welfare issues, which are tremendous, I like the circus. I like seeing people do amazing things. I like seeing feats of strength. I enjoy the tradition of the circus outside of the animal concerns, and I was sorry to hear that it couldn't continue without the animals.
All right, so we may ask you to elaborate on that a bit later. Dr. Davis, how about you? What did you first think when you read or heard the news?
Well, I was stunned on the one hand because, interestingly, show titles usually are sold. They usually don't die, and here we have the end. But at the same time, I wasn't surprised because the Three Ring Circus is a huge business operation, animals, people employed, and thus it is something that is very expensive and dependent upon audiences, and those numbers have been declining for a long time. So on the one hand, I'm very understanding of the concerns regarding animals, but I'm also, like Aaron, sad in some ways to see this incredibly historically important institution die.
Again, we may come back and elaborate on those views as well. So, Adam, how about you? I'm going to guess you, let's just hear what your reaction was.
Well, for me, it was actually very, I was actually in California at a film festival opening of a movie I'm working on with a director, Alex Rivera, called Unchained, about circus abuse, which is coming out, also about how elephants are used in tourism in Asia and how they're abused over for working in elephant tourism. So for me, I was going out to an after party of this premiere of this movie we just launched, and for me, I couldn't believe it. I was in utter shock. You know, I do think, you know, I'm very happy for the animals, but I feel bad for the people that are losing their jobs, but I think that if Ringling would have made adjustments years ago and seen the writing on the wall, they could have actually switched their show more to a Cirque du Soleil style. So it is sad that people are losing their jobs, but I'm very, very happy for the animals. Hope they're placed in accredited sanctuary.
Okay, and I think we'll absolutely at some point, if not now, come back to this notion of the Cirque du Soleil approach, because there was a number of people that sent me questions that were hoping to be posed to the panel, and not surprisingly, many of them are hopefully directed to Steve Payne. So, but Steve, how far back does this decision go within the corporate corridors of Feld Entertainment?
Well, really, we came to this decision this year.
Mm-hmm.
We looked at the economics of the circus and ticket sales in 2016 and what we saw coming down the road in 2017. And came to the conclusion that, sadly, Ringling Brothers as a business model for Feld Entertainment was no longer sustainable. Really, when we took the elephants off the circus, we saw a more dramatic decline in ticket sales than we expected. People really wanted to see the elephant. So in looking over the landscape, the costs, and everything associated with Ringling Brothers, the company decided that it was time to make the announcement that we will be closing it in May.
And Steve, by the way, you outlined this. I guess it's kind of a rhetorical question, but it's going to lead me to something else. Is the decision final, irrevocable by Feld, like that this is the end come May, no matter what might happen between now and then?
Well, yes. I mean, the tours will conclude in May with the last shows in Providence, Rhode Island, and Uniondale, New York.
Because part of the reason I asked that, even though it seemed like it was pretty clear-cut when you guys made the announcement, is that you might have seen in the Herald Tribune, Monday's paper, Nick Walenda from the famous circus family weighed in wanting to see about saving Ringling Brothers and either forging some sort of alliance or at least speaking with the Mr. Feld about something that the Walenda family could do to either buy the circus. So is that something that Feld Entertainment would entertain? Is that even practical on one or more levels?
Well, it's not practical, and nor is it something we would entertain.
Okay. Well, there you go.
I've known Nick for a long time.
I'm sure.
He's been a performer with Ringling Brothers and comes from a very storied circus family. But
yeah.
When it comes to, you know, as Nick's been describing, trying different things, I can tell you from the years I spent around the circus, we've tried everything. We've tried changes to the show. We've tried different marketing. We've tried different storylines. And the ticket sales that we'd seen over the past 10 years were flat or declining. And then when we did the transition of the elephants, that exacerbated the situation. You can't put a finger on just one aspect of it that caused this decision to be made. But we made the decision 2 weeks ago so we could give people one last chance to see Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey between now and May.
So you say you in other words, you announced the decision 2 weeks ago, but I assume there was some time prior to that where people were pondering this before. I guess Ken Feld ultimately probably made the final decision, like, yeah, let's face the music, let's face the numbers, let's face whatever else, and end this thing in May and give people time to go their last time if that's what they're inclined to do.
Well, obviously we've been looking at the numbers for Ringling Brothers for a time.
Sure.
As well as the role Ringling Brothers plays in Feld Entertainment as a company. I mean, most people don't realize Feld Entertainment is the largest live producer of family entertainment in the world. We have 26 tours touring the globe, only two of which are Ringling. So when 2016 closed and we had that full picture of what 2016 looked like and what 2017 was going to look like, the answer, sadly, was obvious that we had to conclude the tours.
All right. So, again, there's some business model, other questions that, like I say, I may want to come back to. But really, needless to say, perhaps, there's, especially for a show like this, I guess, there's an enormous number of questions and issues to address. Many have been submitted to me in the last couple of days, and we only have a limited time to tackle them. So we're not going to get to them all. But obviously, I think we should move swiftly to what, for many, is the central question, what will happen to the animals. So we'll move back to you, Steve, in a moment, but for a more official position on this from Feld. But Dr. Davis, is there a historical framework you could draw on for what happens to the animals when circuses close down? To what extent do the animals typically go to another circus versus sanctuaries or other scenarios?
So historically, circuses have sold animals to other shows. I mean, that has been the kind of business model over the centuries, whereby when a show ends, another show will buy the equipment, they will buy the animals, and you know, these creatures and other artifacts of the show will move on to other institutions. And there's been a long relationship historically between circuses and zoos as well, and other animal entertainment. So that is historically what has happened. I'm heartened by the recent news that occurred regarding Big Apple Circus's bankruptcy, which is very sad because that's a really wonderful, wonderful circus. But those animals are in an upstate sanctuary that is run by one of the Big Apple trainers and who hopes to turn the facility into a therapy refuge, if you will, where people can visit and see these animals. Now, Ringling's situation, of course, is much more complicated because the scale is that much larger.
Yeah,
it's
how
so
many?
More, yeah.
Oh, sorry, Dr. Davis, I didn't mean to interrupt. Yeah. Just curious, how many animals, so we do have a kind of frame of reference, were involved with Big Apple and therefore going to the sanctuary that trainer is running?
So I don't have the exact numbers, so I wish I could give you that information, but it is, I can tell you that they are horses, pigs, and dogs.
I see. Okay, yeah. Gotcha. So, Steve, there's, not surprisingly, tremendous interest in what Feld Entertainment plans to do with the animals once the circus shuts down in May. Like I say, I've received so many messages requesting that I ask you specific questions about this. Many of them overlap, but if I may, I'm going to read at least parts of two that do sort of overlap and may give you something more to respond to. So one says, Florida Voices for Animals has opposed for many years, protested the use of animals forced to perform by any circus. We were first delighted to hear the Ringling elephants were being retired to their conservation center, but we were horrified to learn they are now being subjected to cancer research. This is obviously not retirement. Then it says, we were recently elated to learn Ringling was closing, and again, we're hopeful the animals would be retired. We have now heard of possible plans of them selling animals to the Shriner Circus, which is obviously not acceptable. Is this true? And if so, why are they not being offered to reputable accredited sanctuaries for retirement? In our opinion, the animals have suffered more than enough. Selling and perform with a new facility, trainers, new expectations for performing, etc., will be extremely stressful and cruel. And then, if I might, I'm just going to read one other one because it does hook into our couple things that have come up earlier about the Cirque du Soleil model. So this one says, as Feld has found out, when you make bad business decisions, they will be very costly. Feld saw the trend that people became aware and did not want to go watch abused animals perform as quote-unquote entertainment, but instead of changing to all human acts like Cirque du Soleil, they refused to and continued their bad business practices, which led to the demise of their circus. Now they are trying to fool the public again, claiming that the elephants are retired, but they really have transformed them into another animal abuse model. Their elephant conservation center is nothing but an animal research lab that will be used to continue to breed, confine, and torture elephants in the name of curing cancer. Will Feld Entertainment ever retire all the animals to real sanctuaries? Also, if Feld really cared about people losing their jobs, they would have changed to all human acts and their protesters would have become supporters. So that's a couple of mouthfuls, but Steve, how would you respond to those?
Well, that's a lot to digest in four questions.
Right.
What I'll do is I'll start off with the cancer research. Really what this shows is a fundamental lack of understanding about how the elephants are contributing to research, which we hope might someday lead to treatments or maybe even a cure for cancer. We're working with a pediatric oncologist at the Huntsman Cancer Center in Salt Lake City, Utah, who's studying elephant genetics to find out why elephants, even though they're so large, rarely get cancer. How the elephants are contributing to this research? Blood tests. That's it. Blood tests that we do on a regular basis anyway to make sure they're healthy.
Right. So the only thing that's really part of that research is drawing blood from the elephants, which would at least periodically happen anyway for part of their veterinary care, I assume. And then the idea is to analyze that blood and see if there's something in there that helps explain why the incidence of cancer in elephants is so low.
Well, actually, this doctor has already found what the elephants can teach us. Elephants have multiple sets of a particular gene. You have a set, everybody on this call has a set, that helps your body fend off cancer. Because remember, cancer is just your cells basically run amok. Elephants have 20 sets of this particular gene, and what it does is it roams around the body and stops cancer cells in their tracks. Right now, he's testing which one of these genes has the greatest level of efficacy on human tumors. And so far, his lab research is showing that the elephant genes do exactly what they do in elephants in human cancer situations, as they kill cancer cells. So we're very hopeful that we can learn from 55 million years of elephant evolution on how we might be able to stop cancer in its tracks in people.
So this oncologist or researcher has found already, because I guess one of the first things I've thought many times when I've heard and read about the cancer research is that even in species that are much closer to us, i.e. primates, people have, of course, found the hard way over the years that research on them doesn't necessarily carry over or apply to humans. But I guess if I follow what you're saying, this researcher has found that because of the genes he's identified, that this could have applications for humans.
Absolutely. And as a result of his partnership with a children's hospital in Salt Lake City and Huntsman Cancer Institute, sadly, though, he has access to lots of human cancer tumors. And through exposing them and literally counting cells on a computer screen that are eliminated by this elephant gene, it's called P53 gene, he's trying to determine which one of these genes might be the most effective. And he's also got someone he's partnered with who can help with a delivery mechanism so that potential treatments that could come out of this would be highly targeted, which would remove all the dreadful side effects that are normally associated with chemotherapy and other treatments.
And at the same time, it sounds like, if I followed what you're saying earlier, that this is quite a long-range study. So in terms of seeing results that could help humans, it sounds like that's a number of years, most likely, even best-case scenario, down the road.
Well, they're actually very, very hopeful that they might be able to go further along the lines with this in a number of years. Again, scientific research is just that. It's solving one problem after another and making one discovery after another. So we really can't speculate as to by this date in the future we'll be able to say, yes, this works or no, it doesn't. But everybody associated with this project is very excited and hopeful that it'll lead to a greater understanding of how the elephants might teach us how to prevent cancer.
Okay. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in today, we're presenting a panel discussion about the recent announcement that Ringling Circus will shut down in May after 146 years. Our panelists are Dr. Janet Davis, a professor and circus historian, Aaron Greenwood, a journalist who writes frequently about animals, Stephen Payne, the longtime Ringling spokesman, and Adam Sigalski, a veteran advocate who's long protested the Ringling Circus. The five of us have so much to cover that I don't know that we'll be able to incorporate listener calls and emails, but if you'd like to try, you can call 813 813- 833-993-9966, email dj at wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. So back to one of the questions about the business model and referring to the Cirque du Soleil. Aaron, if I'm not mistaken, I saw, I think, in one of your earlier social media posts after the news was announced that wouldn't really have satisfied you, just because if I remember correctly, that you find Cirque du Soleil type shows not particularly interesting to begin with.
I can't believe you're making me say this on the radio.
Well, no, I just think that because it's kind of germane, because I don't believe you're the only person that might feel that way.
All right, I'll go and say it. I find Cirque du Soleil a little bit boring. It's a little too, a little too perfect for my taste, I guess. It doesn't have the element of spontaneity. Even if regular circuses aren't actually spontaneous, they feel more spontaneous. They have an edginess, a grittiness to them that I think is just more up my alley than the more choreographed looking, feeling Cirque du Soleil.
Okay, any other panels? And people now can feel free to sort of jump in and ask each other questions after, now that we're sort of rolling along here. So Adam, for example, what do you feel about circuses that don't have animals, since you obviously feel so strong about those that do?
So, you know, I think that, you know, Cirque du Soleil is, I've seen the show not live, but I think that the human performers are much more exciting. And, of course, you know, they're not forced to do this with the animals. And, you know, I've spent 11 years protesting ringling, going behind scenes legally, getting footage and seeing these animals, the pacing, the stereotypic behavior, and just the horrible treatment the animals have to live in. So I think, you know, a circus with the human performers, it's much better. And I've gone in and seen shows like Universal, which does have elephants, and they could easily get rid of their elephant act and have a great show. And I think a lot of people would have that opinion. They would still go to a circus, more of a Universal, like I said, she says, more spontaneity, like, it does feel a little more raw. And even the circus goers I talked to going in, they said they don't care if there's an elephant there. They want to see people perform. So that's kind of my take on it.
And Dr. Davis is our resident scholar on circuses of all stripes. So what's your view of either Cirque du Soleil, not necessarily specifically them, but animals, circuses that do not use animals in their performances?
Well, I do enjoy Cirque du Soleil quite a bit. I mean, ironically, I think one of the things I find most fascinating about Cirque du Soleil is the ways in which the show actually uses human beings to replicate animals, because humans playing apes and birds and any number of creatures that otherwise might be in the show. So I find that aspect, actually, the absence of the animal and the human replicating animal, really interesting. But I do also share Aaron's sense that there is, in shows that do have animals, a sense of that interplay between human being and animal. There was a show years ago that I attended that I just loved, a tiny one-ring animal show. It was Circus Chimera here in Austin that had dogs and horses. It was one of the most magical experiences I've ever seen. It was just lovely, the ways in which these people and coordinated displays and acts with these fellow creatures was really, really fun.
Well, so with all that in mind, Steve, I guess the obvious question now is, to what extent, I do recall, I think at one point or another, Ringling did send out one of its units or try an animal-free version. Am I remembering or misremembering that?
No, I don't remember one since I've been with the company.
Okay, sorry about that. But meanwhile, then, what kind of discussion or consideration was there of some version, some scope, whatever, of having a Ringling Circus that would not have animals?
There wasn't any discussion of that. The animals that have been a part of Ringling Brothers throughout its history have and always have remained one of the top reasons people come to see a Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey performance. I'd also like to step back, and some of the characterizations of our animal care are completely at odds with everything that I have seen working with the circus now for a decade. The men and women who care for these animals do it because they indeed care for animals. Trust me, I've seen how hard they work, and there are easier ways to make a living. The bond that exists between
if I might jump in for a second,
animals and their caregivers,
I was just on Sunday seeing tigers.
Hold on, one at a time. Steve, finish your thought, and then it sounds like Adam would like to respond.
I'm not surprised.
Oh, sorry. Did you finish then? I'm sorry. I thought you were still mid.
I'm finished. I'll let you turn it over to Adam.
Okay. Adam, go ahead, please.
You know, I was just there on Sunday seeing tigers pacing back and forth, you know, like frantically in the sun, one laying down panting, and, you know, pacing is a sign of stress. And they're sitting in these complete unnatural situations. And I've witnessed this over and over. I remember one year, Ringling was using fire hoses to clean their elephant. I had firefighters commenting on my page saying, "No way, you kept using a fire hose on the elephant." I have this document. And the next year, Ringling was using little garden hoses on their elephant. So I think they were somewhat exposed by people like myself and other advocates and activists all over the country and the world that are, have been protesting this for so long. So that's just my point of view and what I've witnessed. And I'll end my comment there.
Okay. Well, so I guess even though obviously there's performances, including not coincidentally today, obviously final engagement in Tampa opens up, and there's a number of shows between now and May. But I guess the larger question for this panel discussion really is what will happen to the animals currently performing when May arrives and all the shows are done. So, Steve, am I right in thinking that there's upwards of 20 big cats that Feld owns?
Correct. We're all told on both units, we're looking to find homes for about 50 animals.
Right.
Those include tigers, camels, horses, and some other small animals. And to address, you know, these calls for where they should go, we're keeping all of our options open. We haven't made a decision yet on where these animals may go to. One thing we will say is wherever they go, we have to be confident and satisfied with the animal care that they will receive. So this discussion of selling them to a Shriner Circus is the first I've ever heard of that.
So let me just clarify. So the idea of selling them to the Shriner or any other currently functioning circus, that's not on the table for the animals that are in the Ringling shows now?
Really, it's too early for us to say. We've only made the announcement 2 weeks ago.
Okay, so you're not ruling that out, but you're saying you haven't heard the Shriner rumor that I've heard already two or three times the last few days.
Correct.
Okay, so let me ask you this then. So especially when it comes to big cats, like, you know, Big Cat Rescue right here in Tampa, if I'm not mistaken, didn't they offer some assistance to Ken Feld to, I mean, obviously they couldn't probably take all the cats in question, but I don't think any accredited, reputable sanctuary has room to take everyone. But I've read and heard that some have stepped up and said, look, we're pretty full, but we would find a way to take two here or three there. Did Big Cat Rescue make that offer, and is that what was Feld's response?
Well, we've received a number of offers and inquiries about people wanting to house our animals after the tours conclude, and we're thankful for that. We are compiling all of the offers that we've received, and we'll start doing our due diligence in the very near future and talking to a wide variety of organizations so that we can make sure, once Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey concludes, that these animals do indeed find the very best home.
And what, if you had to say, it sounds like you're still pondering, but what would you say the key criteria would be for saying, yeah, we'll send maybe a couple if Big Cat Rescue can accommodate us, or even though there's been sort of a complicated history with Paws in Northern California and Feld, they've, I think, gone on record saying they would certainly try to find room, and there's others, I think, Wild Animal Sanctuary in Colorado, et cetera. So what would be the key criteria that Feld would use to say, we will or will not send these animals to these places that are actually making space or making that offer?
Well, we've been caring for exotic animals for 146 years. We have a great deal of experience. We have some of the most experienced veterinarians caring for large and exotic animals, I would say, in the world. And one of the basic criteria would be wherever these animals might go to, that they will have to pass the test. And that test is our animal care professionals, our veterinarians, our experts who've been doing this for decades will have to evaluate the care that they would get if we agreed to transfer any of these animals. So, again, we've only made this announcement less than 2 weeks, so it's premature to really go into this is a line in the sand, this must happen, but we do know quite a great deal about making sure these animals are well cared for, and that will come into the decision-making process as we move forward.
And with some of the places I've mentioned, the reputations and accreditation center they have, is there any reason to think that they wouldn't be seriously considered?
If they've, again, everyone who has made an offer to us so far, we're grateful for those communications that we've had so far. All of them will be considered, and hopefully I can come back on your program in May and be able to make some more definitive statements as to where all these animals are now living.
Okay. Well, yeah, I'd certainly like to do that, and I'm sure a lot of people listening would like those kind of updates.
And Duncan, you said that there's a new elephant sanctuary, actually, just Carol Buckley, Elephant Aid International, is actually in the process of opening a brand new elephant sanctuary just about 30 miles north of Tallahassee, Florida. So, you know, there are definitely places for these elephants to go, and I really hope that Ringling does the right decision and sends them to these accredited sanctuaries eventually. So it's incredible having one open this year right north of Florida.
Yeah, I wasn't sure what the timetable on that was, Adam, so that's why I didn't bring that one up specifically, but I figured she would, of course, be, I would think, quite open to. But that, in some ways, that brings me to the Center for Elephant Conservation, which is where the elephants that were retired from the circus last May have ended up. That's a facility in Polk City, Florida. So first, I'd like to ask each of our panelists to briefly say what they know about the Center for Elephant Conservation. So let's start with Dr. Davis.
Yeah, so I actually have visited this center, and it's roughly 200 acres of rolling country, and it is a conservation center versus a sanctuary, so there is, you know, there are animals being born there, you know, there are bulls and there are cows and there are babies, so it is, I think, a different model than what you would see at sanctuaries, but yes, so that's my understanding of what it is.
And so if you've been there, maybe you could give us a little sense of just initially said, just kind of what you, I don't know how long you were there, what kind of visit you were able to have, but just kind of what your observations were of the facility, the care for the elephants, et cetera.
Yeah, so I mean, so what I saw there was, you know, the cows they had, they were in paddocks, but they were large enclosed pasture land. So they were out and about moving freely within, you know, the acreage of this facility. The bulls were separated from the cows, and they were generally, I didn't see them outside. I saw them inside, and I really didn't get a very close view of them. So I saw Barack, the baby elephant. This was in 2013 when I saw him. And so he was, you know, he was out and certainly interacting with the people who were there as well. And so, again, I would say that it resembled more of a, you know, a facility where there is research and it's more, I guess, structurally kind of contained in some ways than what you would see at someplace like Paws or the facility in Tennessee where, you know, the kind of openness and roaming sanctuary-like features are more in play.
Okay, great. Erin, what is your awareness of the Center for Elephant Conservation?
I don't feel like I'm in a good position to say what I think it really is. I'd really like to see it for myself one of these days. I feel like most reports that I've read about it have come either from the perspective of people who are highly mistrustful of Ringling or else, you know, who are kind of Ringling apologists. And I guess what I understand it to be is a breeding facility, and I'm not quite sure why there are elephants being bred there. And you know, my overall impression is that the optics for Ringling would probably be better if it were a sanctuary instead of a breeding facility. But I'd really like to see the place for myself sometime.
Okay. And Adam, obviously I'm sure you're aware of, what's your perception?
Well, I'll kind of mirror what kind of Erin said. Is I haven't, since I haven't personally been there, I've just have seen the photos either coming out from undercover footage and then hearing what Ringling is telling you. And I've heard the same thing as a breeding facility. I have seen the pictures of the baby elephants being chained at night for the break-in process for when they get to start being performing. I'm having to kind of break the elephant in. But those are pictures I've gotten from inside from somebody else, so I've never seen it firsthand, and I'll kind of, I've heard it's a breeding facility and a conservation center. It just sounds like a nice title for it, but, and I think the elephants, I'm not sure, but I think they are kept inside at night and don't have to roam around free like you would have in, like Tennessee where the elephants are kind of, at night the elephants are brought in, but they get to roam free, and that's kind of my, I'll leave it at that.
All right, so Steve, I guess a few questions that just our panelists have raised, either directly or indirectly. Is it 200 acres, the center for?
It is 200 acres, and it's divided up into a variety of different pastures and paddocks so that the elephants are with compatible social groups. Not all elephants get along with all other elephants. Males, of course, are solitary and everything, so they generally do not share proximity to each other, because when male elephants go into a state called must, they will fight, sometimes to the death, over breeding rights. So we're one of the few facilities that's able to handle some large males who can weigh up towards 14,000 pounds. Let me briefly address breeding. Yes, we do have a breeding program. We've had 26 born since it started, and every one is a gift. There are only 35,000 Asian elephants left in the world. If we don't breed them and work with other conservation organizations, they will be managed to extinction, which is what we're trying to avoid. That's why we work with other organizations, both in the United States and in the elephant range countries. We actually have a long-standing program in Sri Lanka where we work to help that government care for injured and orphaned elephants. We just rebuilt their veterinary lab at a place called the Elephant Transit Home, which does just that, cares for injured or orphaned elephants with the hope of releasing them back into the wild. So, again, this goes back to what I said at the beginning. We've been doing this for 146 years. When it comes to the care for these large animals, we have decades, decades, and decades of hands-on experience. And I, for one, have been at the Center for Elephant Conservation almost every month for the past 10 years. And it is an amazing facility staffed by extraordinary people who work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, hands-on, caring for elephants.
And so, Steve, let me ask you this. How many elephants currently live there?
34.
Okay, so I understand what you're saying about the experience. It's 146 years of experience, but 200 acres for 34, you said, elephants?
Correct.
Yeah. I mean, that per elephant, and again, I know you don't label it a sanctuary, and you're not pretending that it's a sanctuary, but in terms of caring, just fundamental care for an elephant, that seems extremely confined. For example, by comparison, the elephant sanctuary in Tennessee is 2,700 acres. The other major elephant sanctuary in this country at the moment, Paws, is 2,300 acres. Now, they have 9 elephants at Paws and 11 elephants at the elephant sanctuary, compared to the 34 that you're telling me that reside on those 200 acres. So that seems extremely confined.
Well, it's really not. We continue to provide enrichment for the elephants that are there. We move them around to different pastures. And again, as I sometimes joke, everyone eventually retires to Florida. And after breakfast, a lot of their favorite activities is to go dig a hole, throw mud on each other, then take a nap. So again, it's for the animals that we have there, we're very cognizant of making sure that they are well-fed, cared for, cleaned, and exercised using the space that we have. And we've been doing this since 1995. So again, it's an extraordinary facility. And it's dedicated first and foremost to the elephants. That's why it's not open to the public.
Right. I was just about to ask, in fact, who and under what circumstance is able to visit? It's not open to the public, but are there certain kind of professionals or journalists, others that are given access to the center in certain situations, or how does that work?
Yes, we have had journalists visit, but more importantly, we've had other conservation researchers and scientists visit, both from institutions here in the United States and around the world. A couple of years ago, we actually hosted a group of Sri Lankan graduate students who were working on degrees in conservation biology and zoology. They spent an entire summer at the center. One of them was actually studying parasites in elephants and was surprised to find none of our elephants had parasites, which he said was completely different than what she finds on a daily basis in Sri Lanka. So, again, the center was started in 1995, and it continues to be primarily for the elephants.
Since the elephants got retired from the ringling shows themselves, how many elephants and the ongoing breeding that happens go to other circuses as opposed to conservation purposes, as you've described them, or elsewhere, that don't have anything to do with performing settings?
None of the elephants that transitioned off Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey, or who were at the center before that happened in May of last year, none of them have gone to other circuses, nor will they.
So even though the breeding continues, there has been no intention and is no intention now to sell any elephant that results from that breeding to another circus?
Correct.
Okay.
Can I ask him a question real quick?
Sure.
Just to follow up, are any of the elephants bred or sold to zoos, per se, not circuses? I just want to see, I've heard a rumor, but lots of people hear rumors that aren't true, of course, and I'd like to ask him directly, if do you sell or plan to sell any of your animals to zoos or even rent them to zoos?
We have worked with a number of zoos around the country. I don't have the terms of all those relationships right at my fingertips. But, again, we want to make sure that people have an opportunity to see these magnificent animals up close in person. If you've been to the Center for Elephant Conservation, you probably would recognize that it's really not designed to be something that could be open to the public. So we plan to continue to work with like-minded organizations so that people around the country could have an opportunity to do what we do every day, and that's witness these magnificent animals up close and in person.
And with that
can I ask a follow-up question?
Of course, please do.
So do you make sure only to sell to AZA zoos, or do you sell to zoos that aren't members of the AZA?
I do not have any information on accreditation for zoos with AZA. I do know that that's a voluntary accreditation, but I don't have any information on the zoos that we've worked with, whether or not they are AZA or not.
So that's clearly, from what Aaron is asking, I guess, not a criteria for deciding what elephants from the conservation center do end up at a zoo.
Well, I mean, AZA accreditation is a good thing.
Right, but it sounds like that's not required.
It's not necessarily a requirement. No.
Okay, I got you. And on a related note, sort of, Steve, because you've talked a couple times already about just the opportunity for people to see these animals up close, I think I read something a while back about Kenneth Feld's hope or thought maybe to, I don't know if he was talking about building a separate facility that would provide that kind of opportunity that, as you noted, the Center for Elephant Conservation certainly does not. In other words, I don't know if it would be considered in the zoo category or some sort of display habitat of elephants. Is that even something that's being considered or might be considered down the road?
I mean, I can't say what might happen down the road, but right now I can definitely say there are no plans to build any additional facility that would be open to the public. I don't know of any plans to do that anytime in the near future.
All right, let me let Mark forward in the sort of home stretch here. This is Talking Animals on Duncan Strauss. We're holding a panel discussion spurred by the recent announcement that Ringling Circus will shut down in May after 146 years. Our panelists are Dr. Janet Davis, a professor and circus historian, Aaron Greenwood, a journalist who writes frequently about animals, Stephen Payne, the longtime Ringling spokesman, and Adam Sagalski, a veteran advocate who's long protested the Ringling Circus. I'm sorry we haven't been able to take calls and work emails in. We may or may not, given all the ground we're still trying to cover here, including come May, when the last Ringling performance has been completed, it would seem that the better part of 400 people will become unemployed. So, panel, offer me your thoughts on this and possible suggestions. Let's start with Dr. Davis.
Well, I would imagine that some of the people, the performers, will go to other shows, perhaps in the capacity as replacement for other circus performers on other shows, because, of course, this is dangerous work, very physical work, and people, you know, have to leave mid-season. So that's one possibility. But for the roustabouts and the folks who are in charge of, you know, the logistical side of things, it's going to be tough for those folks. Some of the management folk probably will be, maybe, and I guess Stephen can probably answer this better than I certainly could, but since there are so many other live entertainment units with the Feld Company, perhaps they will go to those places.
Okay. Adam, how about you? Thoughts on the employees becoming soon unemployed?
I mean, she pretty much summed it up. I think my spin on it is I've seen so many news articles, like, kind of almost making the animal advocates out to be the bad guys and how we're the ones that have brought this down. And I think that the finger needs to be pointed right back at Ringling for not adopting to the times when they knew this was coming. I mean, you have places like, look what's happening with SeaWorld, like Tilikum just died. And you have all this happening in awareness, and you have Lolita at the Miami Sea Aquarium. And we're hoping, you know, I don't want anyone to lose their job, but if there's animal abuse and animals in captivity, you know, I hope they could retrain those people and get new jobs. And, you know, a lot of us have had to get a new job before, and it happens to all of us. So I wish the best of luck to the Ringling employees in the future.
And I will have to say that a couple things in response to that, Adam, is one is that you described as the person on the panel who's done the most protesting, the shock you felt when you're out at that premiere upon hearing this. And I think for some, it might have felt like all the protesting was designed to get the animals out of the circus. But I don't know if people have any sense of kind of overshooting the runway. Like, hey, we didn't necessarily mean to put the circus out of business. We just wanted to get the animals out of the circus. So,
and you know, we tell that to people when we're protesting. When I go there, I'm like, listen, Ringling has a great show, but they'd still have a great show without the animals. The same with the Universal. You have a great show, and we don't tell, you know, I'd go to Ringling if they thought it didn't have animals. So I think we do tell people it's not. We didn't want to promote a business. We just wanted to stop them using animals in entertainment.
Yeah. I mean, one thing I have to say, and I'm not saying, obviously, this was your reaction, but again, I've been, since this all happened generally and then in preparation for the show, I've been studying a bunch of responses, social media, elsewhere online, et cetera. And I have to say, a lot of folks in the sort of activist community seem to have total kind of disregard for the people that would lose their jobs in this sort of like, hey, well, if they're working for a place that did this, that's kind of what you get, which I found a little extreme, a little irresponsible, and sort of just sort of lacking in basic compassion. I mean, some of the people, if they're selling popcorn or they're an aerialist, I mean, I don't know if they should be held in that kind of contempt.
Yeah, I agree with you.
I agree, too.
So, Aaron, your thoughts on the folks that will be out of work come May?
Well, here, let me give you the pie-in-the-sky dream idea here.
Okay.
Attendance at the Ringling Museum and the Ringling property in Sarasota is way up, even as circus attendance is falling. Why not open up a permanent people-only show on that property? It's a huge, beautiful property with tons of visitors, and wouldn't people like to see some of these trapeze artists, some of the acrobats, some of the people who do stunts, just non-animal-type performances there in some sort of a permanent venue? I think that would be great. Or also, I mean, here, I live in St. Petersburg, Florida, where we have Sunken Gardens, which is this old roadside attraction that, you know, was losing money and then became a city-owned park. What if it somehow became a Florida-owned performance type of thing? You know, I'm just spouting off some ideas here, but wouldn't it be great if Florida kind of embraced its circus history and somehow opened up a kind of circus park of that doesn't involve animals and only involves the human performers?
So look at Aaron Greenwood brainstorming for the common good. So Steve, what I mean, I have some other questions for you, of course, but let's get your reaction to Aaron's spitballing this for.
Well, I can't predict the future, but what I can say is right now the final performances of Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus will be in May.
Right.
Clearly taking care of and doing what we can for the people who are going to be impacted by this is now one of our top priorities. We're talking 400 people here, so we're doing what we can to help them with this transition. In some cases, you know, helping them find housing because they've lived on our train for a long time. So this, I mean, this really is an emotional time. I do appreciate the other panelists having, you know, compassion for the people who are affected by this. In some forums, we haven't seen that. But all told, I would say the reaction to this has been one of nostalgia and one of that people will miss Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey. I went to the circus every year as a kid, and 10 years ago was fortunate enough to literally run away and join the company that runs the circus, and it's been extraordinary. And I know when that last curtain comes down in May, there's not going to be a dry eye in the house.
And we just have maybe a minute or two left in the entire show. So, Steve, just a quick follow-up on the employees. So you're going to help them find housing. Will there be other guidance in finding either new jobs, career counseling, placement help, and some kind of financial assistance, some sort of severance?
We are working with all of these employees on an individual basis to find out, you know, what help can we provide so that they are in the best place possible come May.
Okay, cool. Well, that's all we can really hope for and expect. I mean, it sounds like a daunting task for the employees and for whatever Feld and Ringling are going to do to help them. So I think we have reached the end of our time here. There's other things we would like to discuss, perhaps, but I want to thank our panelists, Dr. Janet Davis, Aaron Greenwood, Stephen Payne, Adam Sagalski. Thank you very much for joining us today on Talking Animals. And Steve, I will hopefully follow up with you, as you say, in May. We'll maybe have another chat and see what is going to become of those animals.
I look forward to it.
Thanks, everyone. Thank you, Duncan.
Thank you, Sam.
All right.
Thanks
for everybody for participating. Thanks for listening. This is WMNF Tampa coming up at 11 on WMNF. It's Rob Lori and Radioactivity. And rolling into the new hour constitutes a full 2 hours of interviews, phone calls, news, and more. It's contributions from members of the Stellar WNF staff, including, of course, Everyday Ethics with Craig Kopp. Next week on Talking Animals, Feb 1st, my guest will be Dr. Tim Caro, a wildlife biologist whose new book is Zebra Stripes, which examines the purpose of zebra stripes, debate that extends back to at least the era of Charles Darwin. In this book, Caro presents upwards of 20 hypotheses on the topic. Seems very uniquely specific, but I'm partway through the book. It's really fascinating. So, anyways, hope you'll join me for that. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. This is Talking Animals on WMNF, Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weeki Wachee, and beyond. Homegrown, handpicked music and news. We'll see you next Wednesday at 10 a.m. on Talking Animals. Please go to talkinganimals.net and help support shows like the ones you just heard and some of the other ones we do. It's a lot of work, a lot of effort. There's just one guy here doing all of this stuff. So anything you can do to help support WMNF and Talking Animals in this forthcoming fund drive would be much appreciated. Go to talkinganimals.net for information of simple, easy ways you can do so. Thanks so much for listening. Take care.